It's a sweeping story. And part of me wants to tell all of it. It doesn't really make sense. I don't need to. Many of you already know it. But in order for this little story that was read to you to make sense, there's this bigger story. And it starts in the Old Testament. It starts with the revelation of Yahweh to Moses, and then the establishments of the law and the commandments. And if you begin to read through all that and then read in detail, because there is nothing more enjoyable than reading through Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy straight through. Because it is so awe-inspiring. We argue today about rules and laws. We argue about them all the time. And there are some in there today that are very relevant today, and we're still arguing about them. Homosexuality, very, very popular today. It's interesting to me that in the same list of rules in which that is also, it also condemns adultery. It says that both adulterers and homosexuals should be put to death. That's what it says. It also says that you shouldn't wear clothing made of two different materials. It does. And it also says, by the way, the old translations in the Bible used to refer to it as leprosy. It doesn't do that anymore because we now understand leprosy is not actually a skin disease. It's a nerve disease. So most newer translations have that listed, and there is a debilitating skin disease. So I don't know about you, but I happen to have psoriasis. So I asked Shane one day if he wanted to check my feet on a regular basis like a priest should do. He told me he'd let that one go. The reason I say this is that following rules is something some people love. My wife is a good rules follower. She likes rules. I'm not, you know. We're on a diet where we count calories. Anybody familiar with, what is it, MyFitnessPal? Yeah, you count your calories, you enter them all day and all that stuff. And she's doing phenomenally well, really well. She looks great. I've lost a little bit. Because I have a recognition that every once in a while, I count it all. It's just that I really like hand-dipped vanilla ice cream in a waffle cone. But then when you go to count it, it really messes up your day. So understand there's great value in being a rules follower. And so there are many Jews who became excellent at following the rules. And if you go into the Hasidic communities today in New York, or into the conservative and Hasidic Jew area in Israel, you'll see them. Men who wear their prayer shawls underneath their suit coats. Men whose beard are long and full because of the Leviticus rules say that you should not cut the corners of your beard. So apparently, I'm going to hell. It also says that you should not cut the hair on your forelocks. So they have curls, ringlets that run down their face. And if they're working and they're in the way, they'll tuck them behind their ears. It looks odd to me, but they are following the rules. They often have little things tied to their wrist, because it says in Leviticus you should have the law and you should tie it to your wrist. They do. Sometimes they have it on their forehead. Their doors have the law fastened on it in a little thing that they touch when they walk in. It's called a mezuzah. Many of you have seen those. They follow the rules. They have books upon books of interpretation of how to follow the laws. In Jesus' day, there was a group of people who had become so good at following the law. They would argue about it with him on a regular basis. They were called the Pharisees. I'm pretty sure, and you'll read through the scriptures in the New Testament, you'll see that Jesus often criticized the Pharisees. Understanding what I do about the Pharisees and where they came from, they were the most Jewish people of Judaism of his day. I don't think he disliked them. I think he thought they were the people who have almost got it right. almost. But the problem is that you're not going to get it right with a little bit more rules following. You're not going to do it. But that's what they do. It was interesting to me the first time I got off an airplane in Tel Aviv, because a lot of people from New York, you land in New York, you pick up more passengers. A lot of people from New York on the plane, a lot of them were Hasidic Jews. So when we get off the plane, they all file in front of you because, let's be honest, you're just a Gentile. You have no bearing. You have no importance. Not only that, some of you are women. Did you know that there is a prayer from the Pharisaical tradition where a man gets up in the morning and says, I thank God I was not born a woman? But they are following the rules. Are you aware that the scriptures also say in the Old Testament that if a woman is menstruating, she should not be in public? By the way, if your husband sits in a chair that you have been sitting in, he is also now unclean. That's what it says. That's what the rules say. So it's into that world that Jesus spends the last few weeks of his ministry on this earth. And in Luke's gospel, what you have is this buildup. And by the ninth chapter, he's starting to leave teaching in the Galilee area. And much of the rest of Luke is about his journey into Jerusalem until his crucifixion, death, and resurrection. That's what's going on in this passage here. So you got these people that are incredibly good rules followers, and Jesus knows them. He's a rabbi. He is a rabbi. They come to him, and this is starts in Luke 14. And they asked me, Kelly asked me for scripture, and I said, it's going to be from Luke 15. She's like, where? I said, somewhere in there. So the first thing she did was she sent me back the entire chapter and said, do you want me to put all this in the bulletin? I said, no. We'll pick the little part. But the reality is that it's a flow here. In Luke 14, it says this. One Sabbath, and if you're not familiar with Sabbath, called Shabbat in Judaism, it begins on sundown Friday and runs through Saturday. Nothing happens if you're an Orthodox Jew on the Shabbat. Nothing. You don't do work. You don't do work. You hire the Gentiles if you need to, but you don't do work. Even today, if you go into the Holy Land, here's the deal. Friday is a holy day for Muslims. Saturday is a holy day for Jews, and Sunday is a holy day for Christians. So if you're in the wrong area, you can go 3 days without getting a meal. You better make friends with somebody that's on the other side. And that's the reality of things. So if it's the Sabbath, you don't do anything. So one Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, that's what it says. Pharisees, interpreters of the law, followers of the rules. It's on Shabbat. We're celebrating Shabbat. So we get together. Said he was being carefully watched. The rules followers were watching. What are you going to do if you're a rules follower? We don't want you breaking the rules. Jesus being carefully watched. There in front of him was a man suffering from an abnormal swelling of his body. Jesus asked the Pharisees and the experts in the law. You're the rules followers. You tell me, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? They remained silent. We're not falling for your trap, Jesus. We're not going to do that. We're just going to sit here and look at you. So, taking hold of the man, Jesus healed him and sent him on his way. Have you ever gotten so tired of waiting for the rules followers to do something? Have you ever said in a church committee meeting, we've all become so polite, we're of no value. We're just not. I'm going to tell you a story. I sat in a district meeting when I was still a Methodist preacher. And district meetings are right up there with, here's boring. Here is Methodist district meetings. They're up here. And you meet and you get together as the district committee, council on ministry, discuss the things you're going to do, life-changing things like when's the summer picnic for the preachers and that kind of stuff. And they wanted to have a report from the Racial Reconciliation Committee. And so they said, is there a report? Nobody has anything to say after a little bit. And they're all sitting there trying to be polite, you know, because that's where we are when we have race issues. We want to be polite. We sit there doing nothing because we're afraid we'll do the wrong thing. There's two black guys sitting there. They're good friends of mine. I look at him and I said, excuse me, Sylvester, anything going on with the committee? Nope. I said, how about you? Anything going on? Nope. I said, there's nothing going on. You can go on to the next one. Everybody looked at me like I'm horrified. Let's be clear here. They're my friends. They're black. They know they're black. They know what's happening with the Racial Reconciliation Committee. Somebody say it. Because what we're doing is trying to be polite, and we're not doing anything. The Pharisees sat there and looked, did nothing. Jesus just healed a man. Dwight, who do you want working with Levi? I think you want Jesus, don't you? Yeah. Is it okay to heal? Absolutely. Do something. But the rules followers said no. So then he asked them, he says, if you have a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out? They had nothing to say. You ever seen people that are so occupied and concerned with being religious that there is nothing appealing left in them? You know what I mean? They just sit there. He noticed how the guests had picked places of honor at the table, and he told them a parable. He said, when someone invites you to a wedding feast, don't take the place of honor, because they may have to come and ask you to move. That's kind of an embarrassing deal, isn't it? Excuse me. Oh, really? No, your placards, it's back over there. Jesus said, don't take the place of honor. You know, everybody come in here and crowds around the hosts, and everybody tries to pick up some points. It's not a good deal. A person more, quote, distinguished than you may have been invited. The host who invited both of you will have to come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then humiliated, you'll have to take a least important place. Do you ever play what I call the better than game? I know a lot of people who play the game, and if you're not careful, we all do. It's where you look around you and you find somebody and you look at them, and in your mind you're just thinking to yourself, I'm glad I'm not them. If nothing else, I know you're seeing those people on Facebook. It's not you, of course. Somebody else. I have a bad habit. I play that game a lot when I'm watching TV. I like TV commercials, not because I enjoy the commercial. I look at my wife about halfway through the commercial, and I go, do you realize that there was a bunch of people sitting around a table talking about this idea? And they all thought it was a good idea. I got to be honest with you, Charmin came out with those stupid bears. I want Mr. Whipple back so bad. Who gives a bear a roll of toilet paper? I mean, really. You know, you think to yourself, I'm clearly better than these people are at marketing. Actually, my daughter majored in marketing in college, and when she told me that, I had to fight a little sad feeling inside me. She's a great gal. She's good in business. But sometimes we play the better than game. Jesus is just saying that, you know. You thought you were going to pick this seat. You shouldn't have done that. Which, by the way, what's Jesus going to tell them elsewhere when it comes to this time? Greatest in the kingdom of God is who? Lowest servant. You think you have a place of honor? John and James' mother comes to him later, says, hey, you know, I got these sons. They've been really faithful to you. When you come into your kingdom, is there any chance they could get some special favors? Good place to sit, right hand, left hand. They nailed him to a cross, and nobody was volunteering to be with him then. Servants understand. Jesus said to his host, you give a luncheon or a dinner, you invite your friends, your brothers, your sisters, your relatives, your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. He says, when you give a banquet, he says, how about bringing in the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind? And then you'll be blessed. Better than those people. We all play it. I was a young boy. I came home from school. I think I was in third grade. I told my mom, I said, I made a new friend at school. She was like, well, who's that? I told her his name's Billy, and I used the last name. Well, apparently I grew up in a small town, and so my mom had to find a polite way to tell me that those were not the kind of people we spent time around. I've never forgotten that. I thought that was really odd. I still do. But we all do it. Jesus then goes on to tell the parable of the great banquet. I'm not going to read through that one. At the end of that, he explains the cost of being a disciple. All right, he set it up here. He says, you got rules followers. Rules followers are trying to follow the rules. They're playing the better than game. They think they're better than other people. If you want to be my follower, because I am within the Jewish tradition, he says, I am this guy that's leading. If you want to follow me as a rabbi, if you want to be one of the people I teach, disciple who follows me, here's what you're going to have to do. This is in 14:25 and following. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, even life itself, such a person cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Man, how do you put that in a glossy brochure? You know, if the marketing people got a hold of that, they'd just go, no, we can't do anything with this. You don't mean that. You mean for greater life and fulfillment, for achievement, come to me. For your life to be a success, come to me. For everything to work out, come to me. For your illnesses healed, come to me. Jesus says, no, 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 it's not going to work that way. It's going to be costing you something. And he goes on to talk to him about counting the cost. Then he tells three stories in Luke 15. These parables are only in Luke, these three. It's the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son. And at each one, there's a new thing coming. Because what we've done as followers of the Lord Jesus Christ, if we've taken the most transforming, incredible, and amazing thing in the world, and we've turned it into good advice for practical living. And I'm not opposed to the fact that Jesus Christ can make your life much better, but I am going to tell you this. The process of transformation is called crucifixion. Putting to death that stuff in you that doesn't belong. It's not self-fulfillment. It's not self-actualization. It's not achieving your goals. As important as those things are in life, Christianity is something much, much deeper. And Jesus is something much, much deeper. It says the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. Interesting. You had the Pharisees, the rules followers, the positive people, the elected people, the leaders of the community. They're the ones that were around, but they're the ones that were offering Jesus new ways to do things. And he's like, nah, I don't think so. So who hangs around with Jesus? The sinners and the tax collectors. There is no one more despised than those two groups of people in Judaism at that time. No one. Tax collectors had sold their soul to the Roman government. And here's how they made their living. Rome would say, we need you to pick this much money in taxes and send it in to us. Do it however you want. So the tax collectors would start their books. They'd start going to people. And they'd say, we need this much from you, and this much from you, and this much from you. And they'd do that, by the way, not by themselves, but they would often take a couple of Roman centurions with them. A couple of guys standing there in uniform with spear. Time for you to pay your taxes. Okay, fine. Here's how much it is. Well, that's more than last year. I'm sorry about that. Because here's how they make their living. Anything they collect above what they have to send to Rome, it's theirs. Now, I'm going to bet you, just because I know how this works, they probably kick a little bit to the side to those guys that came with them to take your money. That's what you do, you know. Hey, guys, you want to make a little money on the side? Sure. Come with me. That's the tax collectors. Sinners? Who are the sinners? Well, they're from all walks of life. They still are about the same people around today. They're the ones that if we're not very, very careful, we as Christians look down our nose at them. We may not mean to. We say things like, oh, I love everybody. But we're thinking to ourselves, I don't know why they do that. You know, I heard, doesn't take us long, does it? I heard that they did so and so. Most of you that know me know that I was a preacher for years, and I went back to construction work for the last 10 years of my life. And you go back to construction work, it's a different ballgame. And I worked really hard for them not to find out that I was a preacher too soon. I mean, they're going to find out eventually. But, you know, the last thing you want to do is walk into a construction trailer and look at the guys and go, hi, I'm Reverend David Huff. Yeah, that ain't going to work. So you just walk in, you go, hey. After a while, you talk to people. Once they find out you're a preacher and that you seem to be okay and you don't get after them for all the little things, because the rule follower gets after them for the little things. And before I became a Christian, I had worked around both construction workers and the rule follower construction workers. The rule follower Christians. You know, construction worker hit his thumb and say, boy, I wish I had not done that. And the rule follower Christian would look at him and go, dadgummit, that hurts, don't it? And they'd look back at him and say, no, it hurts. And they'd say something besides dadgummit. And then they'd say, well, that doesn't bless the Lord. Here's what the sinners are looking at. They're looking at the followers of the Lord Jesus Christ to see if we're willing to love them and care about them, even if they're still stinking, and even if they're still making bad decisions. Have any of you ever witnessed to a drunk? Kind of fun. And it probably won't get you real far, but it will plant seeds. I'm in a trailer in Kentucky. I called my wife. I'm a construction worker. I was living in Kentucky, outside of Paradise, which was really not. And I was living in a trailer in Beaumont, Kentucky, and I called her. I says, I'm living in a trailer now. I'm living with Geronimo and Bullet and Danny. She's like, oh, God, no. I said, yeah. I called her back about a week later. I says, Bullet's no longer here. I said, he failed his drug test, got kicked out. I was there. I ended up working overtime, so I'm there like for 2 or 3 weeks in a row. I don't even get to go home. So one Saturday night after we'd worked late, they said, oh, let's go down to the VFW. They got a dance going on. So I go down to the dance. I kind of hang out and watch people and just kind of sit there and thinking to myself, yeah, wow. We go back to the trailer. Geronimo's drunk, and he's beating himself up, and I start talking to him about the gospel. And I'll never forget this. At one point, he looks at me and he goes, wow, you mean to tell me that no matter what I've done, Jesus will forgive me? I'm like, that's absolutely right. That is so cool. Now, Geronimo did not accept Christ that night. I don't know if he has yet, but I know he actually began to talk with me about things that no one had before. Spending time with sinners, when you're not merely trying to get them to follow the rules, opens up doors. Jesus knew that. So he says this, because if you're a rule follower, you're caring about good advice and living your life the right way. So he says, tell you what, there's going to be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons. He tells you that after the parable of the sheep. Now, I want you to think about this from if you have any farming experience, and I grew up working for farmers. By the way, sheep are dumb animals. I don't know what else to say to you. I know some of you had a very idealized version of them, but they're just dumb. And so what you got is these animals in the way. But if you get them all in the pen, they're safe because that's representing several things. You got wool you can trim off of them. You got all kinds of other things. And so that's taken care of. So if you got, here's the deal. You're going to lose some. Occasionally when they're being born, lamb's not going to come out right. So things are going to go badly. It's going to die. If you got 99 in the fold, and you've lost one, most of the time you're just going to write that down in your books as a loss and move on. Lost one sheep. Jesus says, no, it's not that way. Not in the kingdom. They said the shepherd's going to leave the 99. Now I want you to think about this, because no longer today are these Jewish people the rules followers we are. Because now you're sitting in the pews going, well, I'm a good Christian, so Jesus should do this. And I'm doing this, and I don't know why he won't do this for me. And you know what he ought to do is this. And Jesus says he leaves the 99. You're doing okay. You may not like certain things. Things might be going all the way you want all the time. But you know what? You're okay. I'm going over here after this one. And if you're not careful, you're going to start playing the better than game. You're wasting time on them. Do you know who they are? Do you know what they've done? Jesus will tell you the truth. You think there's something special going on in heaven because you managed to stay in the fold? No, it's this one over here. And if you're not thinking like a godly, changed, transformed human being who is aware of grace, you're going to go, that ain't right. That's not right. So then he says there's a woman. She's got 10 coins. She loses one. That's about a day's wages. So she looks everywhere and she finds her coin. And so she safely puts it in the bank and she buys a CD for investment purposes. Is that what the gospel says? No. She takes that and she spends it on a great big party with her friends to celebrate. And he says, that's the kingdom. You see, you're thinking to yourself, wait a minute, I'm not gaining anything. I lost the coin, found it, but I don't get to invest it. He says, depends on how you feel. Because she is celebrating the fact that something good in her life happened. That's what she's doing. I remember when I was a pastor, church people would make a mistake. I don't mean to be, negative, but they would. They'd say to me, Dave, you're the pastor here. You're in charge of the Good Samaritan Fund or the Help Fund or whatever you want to call it. Every church has one. I'm like, okay. Somebody come in, need some money, and I'd write them a check. Give them some money. Pay the bill. After a while, they say to me, Dave, don't you think you ought to be a good steward of our money? No. Well, you know, you need to be careful of that. I don't know. Don't let a pastor be in charge of that stuff. I told him that a long time ago in the church. I said, don't let me handle money. I'm not good at it. Turned out to be true. But I don't think, I'm not a rules follower. Keith would come by about every month at our church, and Keith was a black guy who was older. He had been on down in his luck for a long time. And so this large black man would walk into the church office. And I know I'm not supposed to talk about this stuff because that sounds like we're dealing with issues, right? But all the women in the church would kind of look at me like, what are you, you're going to get Keith out of here? I'm like, no, Keith, come on in my office. Keith was often dirty. Keith always carried all his possessions in a bag. I'd always get Keith a couple towels and washcloths and let him clean up in the sink and do whatever he needed to do. Keith and I had worked out a deal. I'd always keep some cash in my desk, and I'd give him cash every time he came by because he would use it to go buy part of his Metro Pass so he could get around the area. Keith had at least learned where the places were where he could sleep and get food and medical care and that kind of stuff. I just knew Keith as a guy that needed help. It's just that simple. What other people wanted to make sure I would do is hang on to the money and make sure it went to a good cause. I don't even know what that means. I just don't. I gave it to Keith. She spent her money on a party, lost coin. The last one is this story about the lost son. Prodigal son, that's what we usually call. It's also about a prodigal father. Are you aware that the word prodigal has two meanings? It both means generous, prodigious. It also means that you have goofed up, prodigal. And so what you have is a son. And think about this story from the rules perspective. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I am going to scan through it enough to give you the feel. Here's what's happening. The younger son, not the older son, the younger son, not the one who should receive inheritance, not the one who is the firstborn, who is entitled. The younger son comes to his father and says, hey, Dad, I want my birthright. Dad said, okay. Now, think about this. It means he has to do some, I don't know where he got the money. Maybe he had it, but my guess is he had to reshift some assets, whatever it took, to get out the percentage that he thought his younger son should have. Gave it to him. After a while, the younger son takes off. Now, he's a young Jewish boy. He is a rules follower. They're doing their best to follow the rules. He goes off to some, it's the scriptures say, faraway country. We don't have any idea where that is. It says he made several serious mistakes. That might be a paraphrase. I think it says riotous living. Yeah. He made poor choices. We engaged several sessions of counseling for him. At some point, he hit bottom. Have you ever hit bottom? It's not fun to hit bottom. Sometimes you think you've hit bottom, and then you realize it's deeper than you thought it was. To hit bottom. One translation, I've never forgotten this, I don't remember which one it was. It said, and he came to himself. Wow. Have you ever come to yourself? Because there are times I've come to myself and it hasn't been pretty. When things fell apart for me, the only real option that seemed serious to me was suicide. They asked me if I had a plan. I said, yeah. They said, what can we do to change that? Get the guns out of the house. They said, will that stop it? I said, probably. Because if I'm going to do it, I want it to be really sure. So they did. I can't remember if it was that night or the next night, and I didn't realize exactly what was happening at the time. Shane says, I need to take you over to, they're going to have a little short consult with you in St. Louis. So Shane drove me over to the St. Louis Behavioral Medicine Institute. And he says, I need to stick around for a little bit. And I didn't find out until later that he was going to wait and see whether they needed to keep me or whether he was going to bring me back home. They brought me home. Coming to yourself is becoming so aware of your need that you no longer care about the rules. That's where the younger son was. He had a plan to go back home. And his plan was not extravagant. It was not big. He just said, I think I can go back home. I think my dad will let me work with the servants. I think the last time I preached on humility. And it was in Philippians. And it said, you should be like Christ, who in very nature, he took on the nature of a servant. Emptied himself, becoming nothing. That's where the younger son is. Empty. And he just wants to eat, have a little bit of life. That's all he wants, is a little dab of life. So he goes back home and he starts his spiel. Have you ever rehearsed what you're going to say in a situation like that? I need to beg for forgiveness. I'm not anything right now. I'm just empty. And before he can even get that spiel going, his father runs out. He sees him from runs out. And he greets him and he says, it's my son and he's home. And he did not say, we'll negotiate your package for coming back home and you'll have to pay me. No. He said, get the finger. Get a ring. Put it on his finger. Get a robe. Get him dressed up here. Go out and kill one of them cows. We're going to have us a barbecue. Fatted calf is what he calls it. I guess that would be veal, but either way. Now, that would be the story in itself right there, wouldn't it? I mean, there is greater joy in heaven over one sinner that repents. But then there's the older son who stayed at home and followed the rules. Did what he was supposed to. I don't care where you are politically. I just don't care anymore. As Christians, what we've done is we've turned to politics and argued about that to save the world. And in doing so, what we've lost is compassion and care and concern and love. Because we start looking at things like the older brother. I did my part. I saved my money. I worked really hard. What about me? Here's the funny thing. His dad doesn't say, well, to heck with you. Or, you know, I never always liked him better. He doesn't say any of that. He says, my goodness, what's wrong with you? You were right here the whole time. You wanted to have a barbecue with your friends? We could have had a barbecue with your friends. Anything that's mine is yours. Anything that's mine is yours. In the last 10 years, as a pastor Christian, I have moved to become a grace-dominated theologian. People always say to me, yeah, but. And then they have their own buts, and that's fine. I don't care. Because I know that this grace is so extravagant that it's poured out over me. I didn't do a doggone thing to earn it. I cannot do a darn thing to deserve it. I cannot merit it. I am not better than anyone. I'm just blessed to have a God that loves me that much. And I choose to be one of the sinners rather than the older son. Jesus doesn't tell us in this story what happened to him. He doesn't tell us if he repented or not. He doesn't tell us if he finally got mad and took his inheritance and left home. He doesn't tell us anything of that. He just leaves us wondering. And I think he did that so we can ask a question about it. I used to be a very prepared man. I'm not anymore. I think about what I want to preach a lot and write a few notes down and do it. I was supposed to send questions for discussion for you. I forgot. But then I'm a sinner, so what do you expect? I already told you I'm not a good rules follower. So here you go. Here's your discussion questions. When have you experienced grace? That's one. When have you experienced extravagance in your life? I don't mean jewelry. I don't mean possessions. I don't mean homes. I don't mean your car. I don't mean any of that. My wife has stuck with me through some poor decisions in my life. I remember asking her one time if she loved me. Do you still love me? She thought about it for a minute. She looked at me and she says, damn it, yes. It's extravagant grace. Last two questions. Where do you play the better than game? And the very last question is, what do you need to do to quit? To quit. Because this is all about extravagant grace. Because you can follow the rules all you want, and I'm not opposed to it. Clearly, if there are no rules, there's only chaos. I understand that. But if that's your sole purpose in living and following the Lord Jesus Christ, then you miss the point. Our God is a great God. I once asked a question. I said, is there any chance that praise songs can ever become, quote, classics? And there is one that I can't go back to a lot. Our God is an awesome God. He reigns in heaven above with wisdom, power, and grace. Our God is an awesome God. He reigns. He is an incredible God. Let his amazing, extravagant grace flow over you. Would you pray with me? Lord, all we need is you. All we want is you. All we desire is you. More than anything in the world, Lord, may you fill us. May you equip us and may you make us yours. May you wash over us and empower us. May you cleanse us and make us yours. And may you continue, Lord, to draw us close and near and help us to come to ourselves that we may be surrendering all to you. Amen.